And he starts laughing. He says, yeah, I know. He says, God, you and I are a lot alike. He says, guys like us, we never get past the thou shalt not. He said, the first commandment is, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not put false gods before me. He said, I think that originally the Ten Commandments were written as statements of spiritual cause and effect. He said, when they were translated from the Aramaic and then eventually into the Latin and Greek and back down to the Greek and then Latin and back down to the English, he said, somehow along the line they got an authoritarian, churchy spin put on them. He said, but I don't think that was the original intention. He said, it is my experience through my awakening that I can do anything I want and God will love me. I can put anything I want between me and God will love me. The problem is I've just put something between me and God. And he says, when you worship something else, it doesn't mean to bow down to. It just simply means to obsessively turn your consciousness towards. He says, you want to know what you worship? Make a pie graph at the end of your day. And the thing that owns the pie is obviously the thing you're obsessively turning your consciousness towards. And when he said that, I could picture this pie with a little sliver for work, a little sliver for AA, and the rest of the pie was her. And I wish I could tell you that from that moment on, I came to my senses and never did that again. But there have been other times where it's been the business, or it's been another relationship, or it's been financial insecurity, or it's been something I know I'm right about that I have to make you see how right I am, or all kinds of things. And what happens is I put that thing in the place of my life that helping God's kids and God should be. And what happens is I live in the desolation and the shadow. I live in the darkness. And as I sat in that meeting that night, I felt like I was in the darkness. I was the darkness of my spirit. And I was suffering and I was dying. Because I'm cut off from the source, the thing that vitalizes me and that keeps me going. My sponsor sometimes talks about, he says, if you want to see who the winners are in Alcoholics Anonymous, he says, look for the enthusiastic members, the people that are on fire trying to help others. And he says enthusiasm just comes from the Greek meaning entheos, meaning the God within. Look for the people whose lights are on because they're connected to that thing. That's the light in the eyes of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that they've been touched by something. They have an experience. You can't get that intellectually. That's, your lights are either on or they're not. And some days my lights are dim. But I have a set of things I do to turn the light back on again, to get the stuff between me and the light so that I'm not in the dark anymore. What a fair universe this has turned out to be. You don't have to merit anything. You just have to keep the channel open. You don't even have to be good, really. As long as when you're out of line, you go make it right so you can clear the channel again. This is a really a fair universe. So it may be obscured by those three things, but in some form or other it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. There's been something, you can go back to the beginning of recorded history in any culture that's ever existed, and there's talk about something in the human heart that is greater than us. They've had millions of names for it. But a rose by any other name is still a rose. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. Where else does it use those two words together? Search fearlessly, step four. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory. And isn't it odd that it's not until the fifth step promises does it say that we will experience the nearness of our Creator, we'll begin to have a spiritual experience. It doesn't say that after step three. It's not until after we begin clearing away the stuff between me and God that I start to get connected. Frank Buckman, who was the founder of the Oxford Group, and he was very influential. Now, the Oxford Group, a lot of stuff from AA came from, well, came from the Oxford Group, came from some other places too, but a lot of it came from the Oxford Group. And Frank Buckman's awakening was when he realized that when he was blocked from God, he can't turn his will and life over to the care of God. He can't. He can intend to, but his problem is not praying. His problem is removing the blockage between him and God. That's why I have this experience, a lot of people do, a lot of the guys I sponsor, they take the third step prayer and nothing happens. And then somewhere after step five or after step seven, it's all of a sudden God becomes real to them. They start to connect. Some channel starts to open up. Said to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. What a tremendous word for God in capital letters, the great reality. That's what it is. It's right here, right now. The great reality. In chapter 5, it tells you precisely where you're going to find God. It says, there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him in a place that most of us seldom visit. Now. May you find him now. Even as I'm saying that, some of you aren't here. You're in your head thinking, what page was that in? Who can I tell that to? I mean, right now, right here. And no wonder I'm disconnected from God. God's right there, but I'm thinking. I have this fantasy that if I die and go to heaven and there is actually the pearly gates and St. Pete meets me there, before he lets me in, he's going to say, Bob, you know, you were on earth 85 years. We think you were actually present 3 months. The rest of the time you were thinking. We found the great reality deep down within us. When? Okay, that's where. How is to unobscure the channel? And when do we find that? It says in the last analysis. It is only there that he may be found. Boy, was that true for me. Not only is Alcoholics Anonymous the last house on the block, but within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the last house on the block is the fellowship of the Spirit. How guys like me come into AA and I seek power everywhere else. Relationships, prestige, speaking, being a DCM, a GSR, intergroup rep, being the conference chairman, looking for attention, looking for money, looking for prestige, looking for anything I can to validate and secure me, or as it says later on in the book, to wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world. I'm looking for power everywhere else, and in a little over 4 years of sobriety, I crash and burn. I'm still suffering from periodic depressions. I'm still disconnected. God is hypothetical, really. I get down on my knees in the morning, I pray to the air. Really. There's no conscious contact. Just words. And I'm dying. I'm in a state of desperate desolation. And I went back through the steps. And I started, this time I followed the fourth step as it's outlined in the big book. And I start, to my amazement, as a result of clearing away all that stuff, as Chuck would say, uncovering, discovering, and discarding the things within me, the presence of a power greater than myself showed up. And I think that this is the first process since the beginning of time that has ever been actually set up like with a point-by-point directions on how to connect with this power. There's a lot of churches that have ideas about it and different ways to go. But this will work for people who don't even believe. This will work for anybody who does it. And that's our universal experience. It works for, does it? You don't have to believe it. Just do it. Scott.
I'm Scott Lee, I'm an alcoholic. And I have such a good time. Thank you again for allowing us to do this. It's such a joy for me. I was reminded of some of my favorite things I've heard in my beloved home group. One of them is, we're talking about the insanity, or sanity as you prefer, in step two. My sponsor told me, in the history of this planet, no human being has ever been put in an insane asylum for being insane. It's never happened. They put us in there for acting insane. And no one's ever been let out for being sane. They let us out for acting sane. And so the key for a guy like me on the days when I'm absolutely nuts is, if I don't act on it, they don't know, and I can just walk around like everybody else. And it's been working for me for a very long time. And my disease is, it gets up about 20 minutes before I do every morning, some push-ups, some jumping jacks, a few crunches, and it perches up on the head of the bed, and it waits. And when I open my eyes, and it jumps on me. And I wake up with untreated alcoholism every morning, and I have to do the things that y'all have taught me. Lady friend of mine in Nashville reduced what we do to what she called the four ups. Get up, give up, show up, fess up. I thought that was pretty powerful. And another friend of mine, actually he's moved to the Tampa area not too long ago, was one of my teachers from Nashville, said, I work this program to the best of my willingness. I don't know that I've ever done it to the best of my ability. That hit me pretty hard. I think that's true. If booze hadn't done so much for me, it could have never done anything to me. And those are the rules. Page 59. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves should restore us to sanity. I talked earlier about my beliefs are based on my experience, and that includes my experience of you. I stayed sober on borrowed hope. I've got a friend that says faith is really just hope with a track record. And I think that might be right. So if you're here on hope, borrow some more. We're glad to have you. Now take a look at page 60. The balance of most of what I'm going to do this weekend is going to be how I take men through the 12 steps. If your sponsor disagrees with anything that I say, your sponsor is correct, and I'm incorrect. And I mean that with all my heart. I believe God blesses sponsorship. This is just what works for me. This is what I've been shown. This is how I do it. I'm not telling you how. It may sound like I am, because that's the only way I know how to present it. I like to get somebody to page 60, looking up some words. Let's talk about what this stuff means. And begin with A as a question. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own life. Okay, Stanley, is that your situation? Are you an alcoholic? Convince me. Tell me. Now, here are the characteristics. Begin to drink. You have little control, or you mean to quit and you can't. Talk to me about what happens. Convince me that you're an alcoholic. What he's doing is setting his own cornerstone. And the second half of that, can't manage your own life, what happens when you manage your life? Are you recently divorced? Are those handcuffs? What happened to your wrist there? Were you wearing handcuffs by any remote chance? Are you just out of jail? What happens when you manage your life? Tell me about it. Let's talk about your managerial skills. How does it work? B. Probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. Who tried? I know you did. How about your parents, your wife, wives, excuse me, your psychologists, psychiatrists, cops, courts, judges, high school counselors? Who tried? Given the fact that all of those people tried and none were successful, and I'll tell you right now I can't, does it seem logical to deduce that B is true? Probably no human power could have or ever will be able to, since none have so far. Is that true for you? C. God could and would if he were sought. Page 12. The first thing we're going to need to do is to come up with a God concept. And I love here, this is Ebby carrying the message to Bill, slightly above halfway down the page. Page 12 in Bill's story. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? He doesn't say, what do you believe? He didn't say, what did they tell you? Why don't you choose? Pretty interesting. It says the same thing on page 93 in the chapter Working with Others. I'm going to give you a chance to get to it. That's some of the most powerful stuff in this book, in my opinion. So here's this one concept in two different places. About four lines down. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. Here it comes. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. So what I ask him to do at this point is get out a piece of paper and let's talk about what you would like God to be. I want to erase what you think you believe. I don't even think you understand that. Let's forget what they, whoever they are, I don't care how qualified they claim to have been, let's forget what they said. And let's put down the characteristics that you would like to have of God. That's what the book says for me to do here. So what would you like for God to be? And I don't want paragraphs. Jeez, if he starts writing paragraphs, he'll be here forever. What I want is bullet points, individual words or short phrases. So what would you like God to be? And he says, okay, forgiving. I said, all right, that's good. And I'm going to make suggestions as we do this. And if you like my suggestion, put it down. If you don't, don't. Don't let me sell you into this. For me, forgiving was insufficient. I needed a God that was eager to forgive. I was a little bit too guilty to settle for just forgiving. So I've got eager to forgive on mine. He says, powerful. I say, how about all powerful? Okay. How about gentle? He says, how about loving? I said, oh yeah, that's good. Put down loving. How about available to me? How about has a sense of humor? I mean, have a look. You don't think God's got a sense of humor? Look around the room. How about creative? How about wants what's best for me and he knows what it is? So I get him to do as many as he can and then I suggest some. And I say to him, we're back on page 60 now. I say to him, what you and I are going to do here is what the scientists call a working hypothesis. And what that means is we have reason to believe something may be true. We have reason to believe that what you have down here may be true. And the reason we have is we've pretty well bracketed my concept of God. And as you may have noticed, my life is working. So we have a good reason to believe this may be true. And I'm not going to ask you to fake it till you make it. Jeez, I hate that. We faked it long enough. What I'm going to ask you to do is act as if. I'm going to say to you, how do you believe you would conduct yourself if you believe this? And I'm going to ask you to conduct yourself in that manner as an experiment. We'll just see what happens. Don't fake it, but act as if. So let's have a look now at C, that God could. Okay, we've said that this God is all-powerful. So I would say he could do anything. And would, let's see. He's on my side. He wants what's best for me. He's eager to forgive. And he loves me. So I'd say he would. And then it says if he were sought. And Bob said it so well. It doesn't say found. It says sought. Because God's not lost. All I have to do is seek. He says he's come to all who have honestly sought him. So that's what we're about. And when we read how it works, I don't want to tamper with our customs. I'd sure like to mess with this one. I'd like to add one more phrase. Because what does it say after that? It says, being convinced, we were at step three. Being convinced of what? How about A, B, and C? Are you convinced of A, B, and C? Congratulations, you're at step three. It's that simple. Let's don't work too hard at this. Being convinced, we are at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God. As we understood him. I would observe that in the short form of the step on the preceding page, it says over to the care of God. I would note it does not say over to the apathy of God. But here on this page, it says we decided to turn it over to God. And I don't have an editorial on that. I just make the observation. I do have one actually on the word decided. Clearly, step three is not where I turn my will and life over to the care of God, over to God. Clearly not. It's where I decide to. And my sponsor gave me the old one about the three frogs sitting on a log, two decide to jump in the lake. How many are left on the log? And the answer is three. They just decided. They haven't jumped yet. So the directions for accomplishing the decision are numbered 4 through 12. And I point at the first line of step 12 at the top of the page. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result. Sounds a lot like Will and I have turned over the care of God. So how do I get from a decision at step three, and I love Bob carried this to me. We did one of these, I guess, about a year ago, and he said the word decision comes from the Latin scissore, which means to cut. So when I make a decision, what I do is I cut away all of the other options, and I'm left with that single one. So I make a decision. If I could turn my will and life over to God at step three, what would be left? I think we'd have a three-step program. What could be left after that? So at step three, what we have here is a decision. Now, I'm a little bit technical. I apologize for that. I count either eight or nine different individual parts to step three. And I'm going to cover a few of them as quickly as I can here. It says, just what do we mean by that and just what do we do? The first requirement, aha, there are requirements. There must be more than one if there's a first. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Are you convinced? Have you ever seen one? I've seen some people that were very successful on the physical plane, financially, but I look in their eyes and I don't want to feel like they look. And I'm not saying there aren't some wealthy ones that are doing pretty good. I think there are. But that by itself isn't going to do it. That living on self-will does not work. Who do you know whose life is run on self-will that really looks like a success to you? Is this true? It says, on that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Collision! Blam! Broken glass, bent metal, screaming blood. Collision. That would be different from, like, say, mild disapproval or disagreement. Right? I think it's important to look at the power in the words. And it says, even though our motives are good. Now, wait a minute. I've been hearing people in meetings the whole time I've been here say, check your motives. And here it says very clearly, I can get in trouble with good motives. And that's true. And I want to tell you when I got this lesson. I'm a commissioned salesman by trade. I call on major accounts. And I had a customer. He was a purchasing agent at a major account. He represented a third of my income, which at that time was a pretty interesting number. And we were personal friends. Our wives were friends. We're guests at each other's homes. We had spiritual discussions, never a religious one. Really unique. For an earthling, I couldn't believe it. And his son was born a couple of months premature. And the news was not good. And he called me from the hospital. He said, would you come down and pray over this child? I said, sure. And I got in my car and I pulled into the Vanderbilt Hospital parking lot. And I think I could probably show you the parking place I was in. I think I know which one it was. And I sat there doing what y'all had told me, which was check my motives. And I can't answer the question. I don't know whether I'm down there to pray over this child to try to bring spiritual relief to this family or to try to get closer to this guy because he could have doubled or tripled what he was buying from me. I can't answer the question. And this is what I believe. If I can't get an answer, one of two things is in place. Either I have asked the wrong question, and which, by the way, the right question on the wrong day is still the wrong question. I've either asked the wrong question, or it's okay that I make a mistake here because I need to get a lesson from that mistake, or someone else needs to get a lesson from watching me make the mistake and what I do with it. All the lessons aren't for me. It's one of those two. But I did what you had taught me, and I prayed. I said, God, I'm trying to check them. I can't figure this one out. Would you please give me some help? And I'm not going to ask you to believe that the next thing that came to me came from God. I want you to know that I do believe it. And the next thing I got was a question. And the question was, does going into a hospital to pray over a sick child violate any of your principles? And the answer was no. So go ahead and do it. Don't worry about your motive. There are no wrong reasons for doing the right thing. There are conversely no right reasons for doing the wrong thing. For example, I'm about to make up a story out of my past that never happened to help you get a lesson. My motive is for you to get a lesson. It's a great motive. What's wrong here? It's a lie, right? It violates principle. So how do I turn things over to God? And that's simple. Is I do the things I think He would have me do, and I leave the results to Him. When I operate from motive, I'm trying to govern the result, always. When I operate from principle, I'm governing my actions irrespective of result. And I'm not going to get God's ends using Satan's means. It won't happen. And that's where I got that lesson. Top of the page, 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we're trying to carry this message to alcoholics and to have good motives in all our affairs. I don't think that's what that says. Bottom of page 42. Last two lines. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. That concept, that I don't have time to do them. I bet there's another 15 places in the book that talks about that. There are, I'll grant you, two places that the book tells me to check motive. Once is on page 69 and 70 when I'm going to bed with somebody, is it selfish? And the other one is on 100, 101, 102 where it talks about where I'm going, where there's booze served. Do I really have a good reason to be there, or am I trying to get some vicarious pleasure? It's the only place in the book that tells me to check my motives. Everywhere else it comes back down to principle. Always to principle. I've gotten myself in lots of trouble with good motives. What are the traditions? The traditions are a set of principles that are designed to protect Alcoholics Anonymous from my very best motives. That's what they're there for. It's because guys like me operate from motive, and we can come up with really good reasons to violate principle. It's I know I'm hammering that one into the ground, but it's because for me it was one of the most powerful lessons I ever got. Continuing on page 60. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements only would stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody including himself would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. Did you notice this isn't the director we're talking about? Didn't say it was the director. Didn't say it was the star of the show. Didn't say it was the co-star. Didn't say it was best supporting. We're not even sure this guy's got a speaking part. We're sure there are times when he should not have a speaking part. This is just one of the guys. This guy from the chorus wants to run the whole dadgum thing. Boy, isn't that my story? Isn't that my story? And that's what happens to me when I operate from motive. I'm trying to figure out what everybody else ought to be doing. That's one of the great gifts I have today. I don't think I know what you need to do. Oh, boy, is that a piece of peaceful. Halfway down the page, and there's a lot of wonderful stuff in there. Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? I am still so insane that I have bouts of believing if I could get what I want, it will make me happy. How insane is that based on my history? I want to turn the page. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. The root, I wonder how important that is. The root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear. Driven! Not mildly disconcerted on rare occasion. Driven! By 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, there's that motive again, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. At this point, my sponsor told me, he says, we're about to give you the best news you're ever going to get. I said, great, I am really into good news. He said, here it comes. I said, all right. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. Was that it, Jerry? Yeah, that was it. I don't get it. He said, the good news is that you're the problem. If it really is the cops, the courts, the judges, the blacks, the Chinese, the Russians, the PTA, and the ex-wife, you are cooked, baby. Because we can't do a thing about them. Nothing. The good news is that you are the problem. And if you'll bring some willingness to this party, we can do something about that. And I think he might have been right about that one. It says, they arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything. Wonder how important that is. That's somewhere right around the middle, right? Above everything, we alcoholics must, there are no musts in the program, you'll hear that. Well, here's one of them. We alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. And why? We must, or it kills us. Oh, well. A death threat. We're going to see a lot of those today. God makes that possible. I believe I have something the angels don't have. I have the ability to turn my back on God and go right back to doing it my own way. And I believe He'll let me. I'm not saying He doesn't interfere at all, but I believe that there's a limit to God's involvement in my life until I invite Him in. There's a limit. Because I don't think a guy like me would have survived to have gotten to you if he hadn't been doing some things. But there is a limit to it. Unless I invite him in, there's a limit. And it says, and there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. That's so important they're going to tell us twice in this paragraph. Same concept. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would like to. Neither could reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. That is so important they had to tell me twice. So push it. Self isn't going to push the self out of the center. It's not going to happen. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. It says, this is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. Oh. I am riding the shoulders of the real masters of this thing. I have hunted them down, spent time with them. I've asked them questions. That's where a lot of what you're hearing from me is coming. If it makes real good sense, it came from one of them. And I ran one of them to ground a few years ago, and I had him trapped in a hotel lobby for about 4 hours. I asked him a ton of questions. And at one point, I think he tired. And he said, here on page 62, you agreed to quit playing God. I said, yes. He said, how did you play God? And I said, I don't know. And he said, here's how I played God. When someone died, I became angry. And that's me saying, I know who should die. Who should die and how and when. Clearly, that's playing God. And the closer you were to me, the harder I tried to manage your life. My own life and those the closest to me, I was trying so hard to manage their lives, and clearly that's God's job. I also judge people, and the reason I know that is because I had resentments. And the only way to get a resentment is to judge someone, find them guilty, be angry with them, and then feel that anger again. It is that feeling again of old anger that's resentment by definition. The word resent comes from the Latin re means again, like you reread something you do again, and sentire means to feel. So it's when you feel that old anger again, that's what resentment is. And he said the only way to get one is to begin by judging someone. So I know that I judge. Those were his. Here's some I've added. I told you earlier I trusted my motives. That's me playing God. I know how I should come out, so I do anything to make the ends justify the means. I'm wrong about that. Another one is that I needed to know. I asked the question, why? That's my spiritual arrogance saying if St. Scott can just get enough pieces of this puzzle, he can put it all together and make it stay. And it's not true. Another one, I just hate this one, is that I was sure that everything I knew for sure was correct, and those of you who disagreed with me were clearly fools. And boy, not only is that playing God, but it also blocks my ability to learn. And I believe is the source of all anger. And red flags again, this is just me. I have discovered the source of all of my own anger, and it comes from being right. I have never been angry when I wasn't also right. I have been right when I wasn't angry, but I've never been angry when I wasn't right. So I got to watch it when I get angry, because that's me playing God, because I'm back to being right again. God bless these poor people around the world that are murdering in the name of a God that I don't understand. It's because they are right. They are so right that they can do that. Another way that I played God was that I lied. That's really motive again. I think lying is the clearest indicator that I'm back to operating from motive. Because when I lie, I'm governing the outcome. I'm changing how you think about something or what you're going to do. And that's clearly me playing God. Okay, so bottom of page 62. First of all, we had to quit playing God. That's some of the way. And if you've got another one, please catch me at the break. Because I don't think I've found them all. And I'm hunting. Because I don't want to play God anymore. It didn't work for me. And it says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. And then it gives us a really shabby reason. It didn't work. and then it says, next we decided. So, okay, here's the decision referred to in the short form of the step. Next we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He's the principal. We are his agents. He's the father. We are his children. And what I do at this point with a new guy is I say, have you made this decision? Would you like some time? You know, a couple days on this? I'm happy for you to take them. Because we're not messing around here. I'm not playing word games with you. I want to know if you've made a decision. If you have, if you want some time, take it. If you've made the decision, I want you to play this back to me in the first person singular. And he will say, I have decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God is going to be my director. He is the principal. I am his agent. He is the father. I am his child. And I will say to him, I believe you have made an excellent decision, and I want to make a pact with you. And the pact is that that decision will stand until you formally change it with me or one of my successors. Do we have a deal? He said, yeah, we shake hands. And if I bring him through the steps another time, I do not ask for a decision again. I don't need to keep making a decision again. My decision stands. My implementation is better on some days than others. But my decision stands. And then it says, most good ideas are simple. This concept is the keystone. I wonder how important that is. The keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. The keystone's the one in the middle that's shaped kind of funny, shaped like this, that makes all the rest of it work. It was when they came up with the keystone that the Masons could actually build arches. That's the critical piece. And it says, when we sincerely took such a position, that's God's in charge and it suits me. All sorts of remarkable things happened. We had a new employer being all-powerfully provided what we needed. Aha, if we kept close to him and performed his work well. That's what we've been talking about. Established on such a footing, became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs, more and more became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. Isn't that interesting? On the preceding page, it said, above everything. We alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. And how, now having committed to quit playing God and deciding that God's in charge and that that's okay with us, already these things are happening. It's for the immediate gratifiers again. Here we have already in the third step promises. Just from those basic pieces, this is already happening. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, if you're new, if you believe what I'm about to tell you, you'll be impressed. If you don't believe it, I won't be offended. I'm only having one thought at a time. And sometimes there's a little space between them. It's just quiet up here. Stick around. It could happen for you. As we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter we were reborn. It says we are now at step three, and many of us said our maker. So I think the next piece of this, the first piece of step three was on 60. The first requirement, be convinced in life, run on self-will, can hardly be a success. The second piece was the commitment to quit playing God. The third piece was the decision we just talked about. And I like to do it formally. For me, the fourth piece is to read and understand what this prayer says, not to pray it. Let's understand what it means first. It says, God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and do with me as I will. It says, take me. And I've noticed there's a lot of construction going on around in Nashville. And a lot of places they're having to tear something down to stand in there to build something new. There'll be some tearing down. Some things you'd like to have are going to be gone. Some things that you'd like to have are not coming. Some things you don't like are going to show up and stay. All right? I think we need to tell you that. We need to warn you that. This is not, tiptoeing through the tulips. You're not going to like some of this. But it's a package deal. Have a look. My will, two bowling balls. My will, God's will. Pick one. That's what I'm asked to do here. It's not 95 and 5. I was always afraid I was going to work God too hard. Tell you what, I'll cover sex and money. He can get the rest. That's not it. It's pick one. And I want to warn you that you're not going to like some of it. And I think you need to know that. It says, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Bondage means slavery. It means exactly the same thing as slavery. That I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. I would observe that the word amen does not appear here. It's just an observation. The only place that I can find the word amen in the text is on page 76 at the end of the seven-step prayer. And I've got some friends that say everything from the beginning of the third-step prayer to the end of the seven-step prayer is a prayer. I don't know. It's a pretty interesting observation. Continuing on page 63, so having now read and understood the prayer, what does it say? It doesn't tell me to pray it yet. It says we thought well before taking this step. I want to recommend that you think well. God just warned you, you're not going to like some of this. So let's don't be thinking that your will is now going to be done. That's not the package. That we're ready, we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. And then it says, we found it very desirable to take the spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. So the next part of this step to me is to decide if you're going to do it with somebody. If you are, you need to invite them and you need to plan a time to do it. And then it says, better meet God alone with someone who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea of voicing without reservation. That's an invitation to write your own third-step prayer. And I offer that to the men that I sponsor. The book offers it. I offer it. But I'm going to edit it. I want to have a look. And the last one I saw, it covered a lot of things, but it didn't cover the deal where God's in charge, and that suits me. We missed that piece. So... most of the guys I sponsored have sponsored through the years. One of them said it better than anyone else. He said, everything I'm touching is really doing bad. I think I'm going to do it just like it says in the book. Many of us are uncomfortable with thee and thou. I think that's the most frequent rewrite that I see. But it's okay to write your own prayer. And then for me, the last part of the third step is to pray the prayer. And I like the idea of doing it with somebody. We've got a couple of minutes left. You want to... pick up some pieces, or you want to go? You want to just go? All right, let's take a short break. 11 minutes, 9 seconds. If you're new, there's actually was a bell up here. There's not, it's not in your head. That was.
Yeah, we heard it too.
Some of the tweakers hear that for a long time. That's
any tweakers here?
Yeah, good. You done wearing your clothes out from the inside? Yeah, okay. This is the turning point, step three. We ask His protection and care with complete abandon. And this, Scott covered some of this very, very, very brilliantly. I really identify with a lot of it. You know, the actor who wants to run the whole show. This victim of a delusion that we can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if we only manage well. This is the third delusion. This is the one that until I get over this, I don't really have any shot at being happy. I may stay sober, but as long as I'm a victim of that delusion that I can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world by managing well, I will always be in conflict with life, with God, and with myself. In this effort to arrange life to suit myself. And the reason that it's a delusion, because what we're talking about here is we're trying to bring ourselves to the great reality, which is not only God, but life as it is, right here, right now. And the reason that it's a delusion is that if you could step back from yourself objectively and look at yourself over the years as someone else may have been able to do, what you might see is the same thing that I saw. That whoever was making decisions for this person was out to kill them. I don't think there's a demographic on the planet that's ever put more time, spent more money, more energy, more focus, more obsessive determination on making themselves happy and satisfied as we have. And the end result is some of us wished we were dead. I had a guy 2.5 months ago named Richie Conway. Richie C. from Las Vegas, Richie Conway's dead now, from Las Vegas, took his own life with 20 years of sobriety, physical abstinence from alcohol. And Richie had everything. He had everything he'd ever want. I've seen so many people commit suicide with long-term sobriety. And it's the same story in every case. These people come into Alcoholics Anonymous with nothing. They've burnt their life to the ground. They surrender to the bottle. They come into AA, but they don't want to do the work to surrender to life itself. They can't get the second half of step one. And so consequently, they don't have to do the work to seek a new manager. And they're at the helm of their own ship, sober. And I think most of us get sober with an unconscious agenda or checklist. And with the checklist, it goes something like this. I'm miserable, but if I had a big house, $1 million in the bank, a six-figure income, the right relationships, a good car, respect, and 20 years of sobriety, surely then I will have arrived. I will be okay. And oddly enough, everyone I've ever seen take their life or drink again with long-term sobriety had taken it at a time where they had achieved everything on their checklist. A victim of a delusion that we can wrest happiness and satisfaction of this world if we only manage well. My friend Richie would not give up the helm of his ship. I sponsored him for a week or two, 9 years ago maybe. And it was probably I think that week or two was really more recovery than he was really interested in. It was just I was a great sponsor up until the point where I wanted him to do some things. And it was, he doesn't want to give up. And instead, he didn't want to, the inventory. I wrote my life story when I was new, but he never did what we do in our book. And he didn't want to do anything other than go to a meeting every day where he suspected his name was, does anyone want to share, and dump his garbage in the meeting and then try to get fixed and get attention. He didn't want to do anything other than that. So consequently, he didn't want to do what I wanted him to do. He quit me as a sponsor, didn't have a sponsor, and he got on some medication, which worked great right up until the time where it quit working. And now he's got several years of putting all those unresolved conflicts and emotions in the bank, and they're gaining interest. When the medication stopped working, he was in a bad spot. So he took a knife with a blade about this long, and he slit his veins up and up this right way, the right way, up the arm. And it didn't kill him, and he ended up in the hospital, and they're talking about amputating his arm. He checked himself out against medical advice, got a pistol and put it to his head and blew his brains out. And Richie had a great life. He had the life that most newcomers would look at with his property, money, and prestige and say, I'd like to have what he has. Isn't it weird that that's like that? I remember the first time when I was new and I was struggling and I didn't have anything financially, and I saw a guy drink again whose life I thought was perfect. And a guy who had come out of nothing materially, and he was doing very well, and he drank again. I thought, it blew my mind. I thought, why would he drink? He's got everything. And I don't think that the material well-being helps us, the material stuff, really. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I'm financially in a very good shape today, but it's not my source. As a matter of fact, I think I understand exactly why some of these guys, why Frank put a plastic bag over his head with 23 years of sobriety with a big house and a Harley and a truck, custom truck and a Corvette and all everything he'd ever want. The abundance does not make the vacancies smaller and more bearable. Actually, I think the abundance makes the vacancies stand out against the backdrop of it in starker and more painful relief. There was a time in my life when I was really, really pathetically down and out. Because when alcohol stops working and there's no more relief in the bag and the bottle and you're like me, you give up. So I give up. I don't care about working anymore. I don't care about anything. So I rendered myself all the way down to a guy who's living in an abandoned building, sleeping on the floor, and I'm dirty, and I don't bathe, and I look horrible. I smell horrible. My surroundings look horrible, and I feel horrible. I'm horrible on the inside, I'm horrible on the outside, but there's a continuity between my insides and my outsides. You clear up the outside, you put me in a $3 million home, and with the same vacancy in the center of my spirit, and the $3 million home does not make the vacancy go away. It makes it more sharper and more painful. Now what the hell's wrong with me? And eventually, alcoholics of my type will get to the, you throw instant gratification events in front of you to keep you going. Well, I'll go to Europe. Okay, and then you went to Europe. Now what? I'll do this. Now what? I'll do that. Now what? And eventually, as Chuck says, you get to the point where you can't put anything between you and you. And that's where you come to terms. You either come to the table with God in this process to clear away the things between you and God, or you're in trouble. And I understand this. This, and that's why it's a delusion. That's why when it's, Scott said, covered that line, first of all, we had to quit playing God. Why? Because it's bad? No. This is spiritual pragmatism. Because it doesn't work. If it worked, if we weren't victims of this delusion, we could rest. If we could actually manage ourselves to a better state of living and a better sense of satisfaction and happiness, then Alcoholics Anonymous would have a process for that. We'd be doing like Anthony Robbins crap and shit. You know, we'd be trying to help you to better manage your own life. But instead, there's something wrong with us that we've managed ourselves just about to death. I wish there should be a one of the great lines to tell a new guy is who's in the middle of planning his life again, and he's at the helm of his ship, 6 months sober, is you got to come up to him and say, so, how's that working for you? And isn't that the key question? How's this working for me? And it's a delusion, because it doesn't work. It's a delusion. This thing about selfishness and self-centeredness, I couldn't see that I was self-centered. Now, I know some of you sitting out there find that hard to believe. You'd think it would be very evident to me that I'm self-centered, but
I couldn't see it. I just couldn't see it. First of all, I got misjudgments about what a self-centered is. I think a self-centered person is someone who's very confident and successful and kind of all put together and doing very well. And I don't think I'm self-centered because I feel like crap. I feel less than everybody else. Isn't it weird that I could feel less than everyone else and then be picking you apart at the same time and knowing what's wrong with you? It's a weird dichotomy. They say the alcoholics are the only people on earth that can lay in the gutter and look down on the rest of humanity. I mean, that's really true. So I'm sitting in a meeting one day, and I'm in my early sobriety, and I'm the subject, self-centeredness. And I'm not really listening. It's one of those meetings where they go around the room. And I don't really start listening until it gets into the range where I'm starting to realize I'm going to be asked to share. And so now I'm in my head, and I'm starting to figure out what I'm going to share. And while I'm doing that, a woman is sharing, and out of my peripheral hearing, I hear her use the term that she was totally self-absorbed. And you could have hit me. It was like hitting me with a 2x4. I went, oh. Because I'm sitting there. I'd been thinking about my sex life, my finances, my jobs, how I feel. Then I started thinking about, I'm going to have to share. What should I say? I started thinking about what I'm going to share. What you're going to think of what I'm going to share. How I should sit when I'm sharing it to look like I'm confident and know how to present it right. And I just realized, she used the word self-absorbed. I realized I was so absorbed in myself. That's what they're talking about when they say self-centered, that I'm simply centered. My consciousness is centered on myself, on me, my feelings, my day, my life, my relationships, my finances, what you think of me. Oh, that's a big one. I think alcoholics spend more time thinking about what other people might be thinking about them than anybody on the planet. I mean, it's a big deal. And I started to see what they meant by self-centeredness. And when you get that, when it says it's the root of our trouble, it's underneath everything. And it was like it opened the door. It was almost like the curtain went up and I could see the magician's trick from, it's like looking over his shoulder. I could all of a sudden see this self-centeredness in every aspect of my life. I realized it's why I have these conflicts at work with employers, and why I'm always the guy that's judging my way out of a job, and why I was in danger of judging my way out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and why I'm in conflict. Why I don't really feel like I fit out here in this world. Because what's true? Self-centered, self-absorbed, self-focused, self-obsessed people like me, the reality is I don't even live out in this world. I live up in this one, between my ears. And my vision is in the wrong direction. That's why from a lot of my life when I would sober up, life seemed so distant and I feel so disconnected from that. And I drink again on the hopes of the magic. And what's the magic of alcohol for a guy like me, really? Isn't it that at one time it relieved me of the bondage of self? Isn't it one time alcohol would take a guy who is disconnected and lonely and stuck up in my head, a guy who doesn't fit, and after 5 drinks I just fall off of me. And all the me that is between me and you goes away. And I'm free. I drank for an anticipation of freedom. I didn't know it was freedom from the bondage of self. I didn't know that alcohol relieved me of the bondage of self and let me come back out here with you and be present. If you remember the early days of your drinking, a guy like me, I would get sober. I get so locked up in my head. I just get my life and my feelings and me on me like that creature, an alien that attaches itself to your face. And I could walk into a bar and
5 drinks, and I just come off of me. And I'm free. And I'm free. And then when alcohol, the progression of the disease, the problem with that is that stops working after a while. If I could get that effect from alcohol today, I would probably still have drank. I would have never gotten sober. I would have paid the price. 30 days in jail once a year, for that absolutely would be worth it for me. But that stopped working, and then I started being just as disconnected and alone, and alcohol stopped relieving me of the bondage of self. It stopped being a treatment for the self-centeredness. And it was a good one for a while. Remember in the early days of drinking? After about 5 drinks, you could really be present. You could listen to your friends. Man, you felt like close to them. Oh, she said that to you. Oh, man, I'm so sorry. And you really meant it. I was there. I could hear you. I'm right there. Because I was relieved of the bondage of self. I could feel honest emotions for people. I could love. Or at least the closest a guy like me could ever get to it. I felt intimacy with people that I was running with. But not in the end. So in the third step prayer, which is my friend, a friend of mine calls it the formal terms of surrender. And I'm embarrassed. Well, I'll tell you two little stories and I'll shut up. When I was towards the end of my first year of sobriety, I took the third step prayer on my knees with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took it thinking that I knew what I was doing. But I had no idea. I just want to fit. I just don't want to drink no more. But I don't know what I'm doing here in this third step. I don't have a clue. And I said that prayer, and when I said to God, here, for you now, for you to build with me and do with me as you will, I'll tell you what happened to me is God got busy. And he started building with me and doing with me, and it made me nuts, man. I'm telling you. Within the next 10 months of my life were crazy. I'm dating this girl. She's gone. She's gone. I have this job, not a job, I have a career. And I lose the job and I cannot get another job in that venue. I put resumes everywhere. Every single door is closed. And right after that, my roommate moves out. Now, with the job, I can barely make it to pay my bills and rent and stuff. Now I have no job and no roommate to cover half the rent. I'm like seeing homelessness coming at me. I found myself just nuts. I started, crazy emotional things started happening to me that I didn't understand. And I would be sitting somewhere and all of a sudden I'd just start sobbing. As if emotions that were pent up within me for years started coming out and they weren't coming out pretty. And it's freaking me out. I went to my sponsor. I said, I'm getting worse here. He says, no, you're not. You're right on track. And I thought, what a train wreck. What are you talking about? And what's going on is God's building with me and doing with me. Here's the problem. He never sent me the game plan. He never sent me the blueprints. If he would have sat down with me and said, well, okay, Bob, you're like an abandoned building. To rebuild you, we're going to have to tear a lot of crap out. We're going to have to get that job. It's got to go. Because I don't even think you're going to stay sober in that venue. And we're going to take you over here and you're going to start over here, minimum wage working over there. And you're going to end up owning that corporation one day. And you're going to retire young and you're going to retire well. Would that be okay for you, Bob? Well, yeah, God, if you put it that way. But he didn't say that. He just took the job. But he said, this girl you're dating, she's about to go off the deep end, and she's going to drink, and the guy that's with her is going to drink. We got to get you out of there. I said, well, yeah, get me out of there. Yes. He would have said, you know, your roommate's got to go because there's a guy from Florida that's moving to Las Vegas, and he's going to need a place to live, and you guys are going to be roommates And you guys are going to do a lot of 12-step work together, and it's going to take your program to another level. Would that be okay for you too, Bob? But he didn't say any of that. He just took stuff, and everything that he took, everything without exception, and this is not podium talk, everything that he took had to go. So what's the problem? The problem is that I've said the third step, and I have, with the intention of turning my life over to the care of God, but unbeknownst to me, I've returned my will. I've retained my will, which is my judgment, my opinion, and my perspective of my life. And I think you could keep your life if you could surrender your will and probably survive. But I've done the opposite. I've kept my will and tried to give him my life, and it doesn't work. No wonder I still suffered from anxiety almost to the point of panic, because I'm still in the driver's seat. Here, God, here's my life, but here's a list of how it better go. And you know what depression is? That's when God stops doing your will, right? And so I don't know what I'm saying. And what is the third step, these formal terms of surrender, except really when in the beginning of the prayer, when I offer myself to him for him to build with me and do with me, essentially I'm taking a stance that from this moment on, because of my abject failure, drunk and sober, to make me better, is that I'm going to make my life none of my business. My God, it was my only business for all these years, and look what happened. How successful have I been? So I'm taking a stance in a position, and from now on, I'm going to try to head through the rest of these steps. The end result is I want to make my life none of my business. As Scott said, I don't want to make you my God, I want to make me your man. I want to be your go-to guy. And now I can't do that. And I don't know an alcoholic that can. You can't. You can get it. Oh, I'm killing myself with this self-obsession and self-concern. Okay. All right. I'm just not going to be self-concerned ever again. How do you do that? You can't. How does a guy who's thought about nothing and worried about nothing except himself for decades stop that? I can't unless something happens. Unless God does something. So I'm begging him to relieve me of the bondage of self. And bondage is a good word. It's like slavery. I am shackled to my own self-obsession. And I can't get free of it. I go to a new place. What happens when I get there? First thing I wonder about is, what's it have to do with me? What here is that might be threatening to me? What here that I have to worry about? It's me, 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 me. So I'm hostage to that. And so I ask God to relieve me of the bondage of self and to take away my difficulties with this. And I'm embarrassed to tell you, I was almost 11 years sober and I'm with a new guy. And I'm taking him through the steps and we're going through this part of the book and we're talking about the selfishness and the self-centeredness. We get up to the third step prayer and he's reading it and we're about to get on our knees and say it. Before he gets on his knees, I say, I want you to tell me what you think you're about to do. And he says to me, well, I guess I'm going to make a decision from now on to make my life none of my business. It's where the direction I'm going to head. And I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self. And if he'll take away my difficulties with the bondage of self, so that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help. And he goes, those I would help. Oh, so this is just about, we're doing all this just so we can help other people. I was almost 11 years sober, and I went, holy shit. I didn't get that. I got to take away my difficulties. Oh, I get that, and I got a list, too, I'm telling you. But it's not about me.
is take away my difficulties so that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help. That's a contractual thing. The implication is I'm going to have to help some people. So this is not about me. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a self-help program. And I don't know where all this crap out of treatment tries to make us into self-help programs. It's a selfish program. No, it's a selfish disease, but it's not a selfish program. I don't know where that stuff is. This is not a self-help program. Never was, never will be. It's a program of self-abandonment and service. You see, I almost died trying to fix myself. I almost died trying to help me. How's that working, Bob? And so I give up. I come here and I give up. I can't fix me. So I'm going to be about the business of these steps, and I'm going to hope that maybe if I do these steps, something will happen to me. Something will awaken within me. And I'm going to devote the rest of my life to clearing the channel, making the amends, doing everything necessary so that I can go out and help God's kids. And then let's see what happens. And what happens? It's a story as old as Alcoholics Anonymous itself. We bang our head against life itself over and over again, frustrated, demoralized, absolute failure. And we come to AA and we just, out of absolute desperation, we give up. And I give up. I'm just going to do AA. And 3 or 4 years later, you realize everything I fought to have has come to me. In here, and slowly but surely cause and effect eventually out here. Cause and effect. I got sick by getting sick in here, and my life followed. I didn't end up homeless just like that. That happened through a slow series of internal compromises inside myself. The little deceits and the lies to myself and the self-delusion. I didn't just get sick overnight. It was an incremental step into oblivion. And the road out is the same. You start getting better on the insides, and the outsides eventually follow. That's why you will rarely ever see somebody who's right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor, working these steps, trying to live a surrendered life, that their life doesn't look good. You rarely ever see that. Now you can see some people that are sober 10, 20, 30 years that are miserable, but they're not doing this thing, and they don't have a car full of newcomers. Their life is all about them. So I do this thing. The formal terms of surrender, because I don't have a choice. The decision has been made for me by the painful reality of my life. I'm alcoholic. I am in a trap I can't spring. And I can't manage my own life, and it's not like I haven't tried. And no human power. I've tried everything. I've tried every medication. I've tried church. I've been to some seminars. I went to a seminar one time. They wouldn't let you sleep. They made you sit up all night and talk about your feelings. I'm telling you, it changed my life for 3 weeks. And then I was back to being me. William James was he's often referred to as the father of modern psychology. He was a lecturer, and he gave a series of lectures that was eventually made into a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience, which oddly enough was the first book that Bill Wilson ever read when he got sober. It was given to him in Towns Hospital after he had his spiritual experience in the hospital. And I suspect that Bill Wilson's experience with that book may have been like my second visit to it. My first time I ever tried to read it, it was just hard to read. It's brutal. And then I went back at many years of sobriety and read it again, and I struggled through it. And I discovered an amazing thing that William James had. From a scientific point of view, he wanted to understand and scientifically study people who have had born-again or conversion experiences. Because he's observed this phenomenon and how it changes people's lives. And he discovered by doing like a chronicle study of all these experiences that invariably those experiences had two things in common. The first thing is you never have that experience when you're on a roll. You never just got back from Vegas, you won the mega bucks, you married a showgirl, your friends love you, and you just got a promotion at work, and you go, I think I better find God. I mean, it's never like that. It's always where you're broken and demoralized, and you're in a place where you can't stand you. And we all get that. We all get that. I mean, why else would I approach God and try to surrender to God? I don't like God. First of all, he has my job, I suspect. I've always thought that. And the second thing that those experiences invariably have in common is that they're transitory experiences, which means that eventually, often, the shine of them wears off, the old self reasserts itself, and they don't last. And that's so, we know that in AA. Bill didn't know it, but we know that today because one time I was doing a workshop on step two, and just on a fluke, I asked for a show of hands of people who had been saved or converted or something like that and then drank again after that. And I was amazed about a third of the room raised their hand. What a common experience. Matter of fact, Alcoholics Anonymous is, we are a fellowship composed a lot of the failures of therapy and religion. I mean, we're the people who tried to stay sober in all those other venues. And I think God created AA for us. Because nothing else seemed to work. He was tired of watching his kids suffer. And so Bill Wilson has his spiritual experience in Towns Hospital, and he realizes that somehow he's going to have to figure a way that he must do something to keep this alive. And so two things happened that didn't happen to all the cases that William James talked about. One is he aligned himself with a group of like-minded seekers of God's will and tried to develop a plan to keep that active, and even probably more importantly, came to him the idea that if he threw his life obsessively into trying to help other people, that maybe he could keep it alive.
Yeah.
Absolutely love the way he does that stuff. Very powerful for me. A couple of little points I want to pick up here on this is one of the favorite things I ever heard. It said, for those of you who are hiding behind the fact that the steps are suggestions, we have good news and bad news. You're right, they are just suggestions. That's the good news. The bad news is they're the only suggestions we got. So welcome to AA. We're talking about surrender. There's a wonderful story that came out of World War II. At the end of the war in the Pacific, Douglas MacArthur met with the Emperor of Japan on the battleship Missouri to sign the surrender documents. And they're all in their formal regalia. And after whatever ceremony, the Emperor of Japan walks up to these giant documents and he leans down and begins to read. General MacArthur says to him, don't read it, just sign it. That's what step three is to me. I don't get to read it. As Bob said so beautifully, the rest of my life becomes none of my business. Not my responsibility anymore. I've signed the blank piece of paper at the bottom. I've invited God to fill it in any way he wants to. My problem is I can't remember that all the time. That's why things upset me. I had an experience a few years, well, I was sober 6 years and I moved out of the home my first wife and I were living in. And I moved out because I realized I was about to strike her. And she told our daughter a couple of years ago that when I get sober, that I changed, and she didn't, and I think that's correct. I agree with that analysis. And I left because I was concerned about what I was going to do. And I got moved into a little nasty little apartment. I'm used to living pretty good. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't believe in divorce. I also knew if I continued to live with her, it was a question of time before I was going to hit her. And I was given a gift, and I'm going to share it with you just in case somebody can use it. And the gift was three prayers, and I prayed them every morning. The first one was, God, if it's your will for us to be together, put us together. And the second one, God, if it's your will for us to be apart, put us apart. Those are the easy ones. Here's the tough one. God, if it's your will for me not to know today, leave me not knowing. For me, it's the second half of the first step in prayer form. When I can pray that, if it's your will, in the middle of a big deal, if I can pray that, leave me not knowing if that's your will for today, and mean it, I can be at peace. My sponsor told me serenity is not freedom from the storm. Serenity is peace in the midst of the storm. And the only way I can do, the only way I can get that is to stay in the present with God. I believe in big deals. I hear people say there aren't any big deals. I have been unable to locate that in the book. I sponsor two men who have had their teenage sons killed since they've been sober. You don't want to be around one of them saying there aren't any big deals. That would be a mistake. This concept about helping others that we found here in the third step prayer is all over this book. I can probably name 15 places, and I bet there's 25 or 30, maybe more places where the prescription is constantly for me to go and help someone else. It just constantly comes back to me going and helping somebody else. And there's a very, very powerful concept, and I'm surprised Bob missed it because it's the first time I'd ever heard it was, I think, the last time that we did this thing. And how it works on page beginning at the bottom of 58, this concept that I have never seen it put this way, and it's one of the most powerful things I have ever run across. It says, remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. What Bob said so eloquently was, now isn't when I find God, it's where. If I'm going to find God, I'm going to have to be here, present in my own life. My God is the God of right now, the great I am, not I will be or I was. And here, now, this place, not this time, is where I